Martin of Tours, a Roman soldier and a Christian, entered one day into a city. It was a bitter and cold day, and shortly after entering the city, he encountered a beggar who was shivering from the cold and somewhat blue from the bitterness of the weather. Martin could not do much, but he could do something. So he took from his own back his soldier's cloak. He had worn it in many battles. It was worn and tattered and torn, and with his sword he cut it in half, gave half of his cloak to the beggar, and went on his way. When the sun had set and the soldier Martin had made his bed for the evening and went to sleep, he had a dream. And in his dream he was in heaven, and he saw before him there a glorious scene of all the heavenly angels, and sitting in their midst was Jesus. He was struck by what he was wearing. He was wearing half of a soldier's cloak. And the angels about him noticed it too. And one of them turned to him and said, "Master, why are you wearing that battered old cloak? And where did you get it?" And Jesus said, "My servant Martin gave it to me." The message of the lesson from the parable of the Last Judgment is very clear. No one can miss it. God will fully and finally judge you and me on the basis of our reaction to human need. We are saved by faith, no question about it, but faith without works is dead. We will not be judged on the knowledge we have accumulated, or how well known we might be, or how much money we have made or accumulated, but on the help we have given to those who need our help. Any reading of this parable of the Last Judgment, I think, leaves with the reader three foundational impressions. The first is that Jesus Christ is sovereign. It is clear that he is the supreme ruler of heaven and earth, and in the scene before us, it is obvious that he has been given all authority on heaven and on earth. Then we have the impression that service is crucial. We do not have the luxury of seeing and knowing about and observing human need about us and doing nothing. We cannot be a detached, uninterested, uninvolved spectator when human need is obviously about us. We shall be judged on how we respond to that need. The strong must respond to the needs of the weak. The capable must reach out to the incapacitated. The healthy must respond to the needs of the hopeless. Our talents must be put to use in the common life of common needs. As Paul wrote to the Roman Christians, we who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak. The parable of the Last Judgment does not merely articulate this as a principle, but it gets very specific about it. The hungry ought to be fed. The thirsty ought to have water to drink. The stranger is to be welcomed. The naked ought to be clothed. The sick must be visited. The prisoner is remembered, and we call to inquire and visit the prisoner. All of us, rich or poor, sick or well, in jail or out, all of us are precious in the sight of God. All of us have found a place of compassion in the great and loving heart of God. Joaquin Miller, reflecting about the poet Byron and thinking about how Byron was roundly scorned by many, as he thought about all of that and the condemnation that comes so quickly to our lips, Joaquin Miller wrote these words: "In men whom men condemn as ill, I find so much of goodness still. In men whom men pronounce divine, I find so much of sin and blot. I do not dare to draw a line between the two where God has not." The third impression that you get as you read this parable is the impression that there is a separation. It is clear that a failure to respond leads to a great separation from us and God. It is not sufficient to say, "We didn't see, We didn't know, or God forbid that we did not care about the need to be separated finally and fully and forever from God creates a great gulf that cannot be bridged. So how shall we respond to this parable in light of the challenges before us in the Atlanta Project? Well, I would observe, first of all, that it is reality that the gap is widening between the haves and the have-nots, not only in the nation as a whole, but in Atlanta in particular. It is widening across the country, and it is widening here. Demeaning poverty reduces life for those who caught in it to the basic animal response of survival. There are conditions festering away in this city that those of us who sit here today can scarcely imagine and hardly even know about. Nor can we identify with what some people are experiencing as I speak. There are people who wake up every morning who begin the struggle of how to keep body and soul alive on the streets of Atlanta. The street parent, the street people, the single parent with fatherless children, children with no male models, and into that festering cauldron of hopelessness and despair, desperation and anger take root, violence becomes the order of the day. There is a constant search going on for a way out. Atlanta has a higher proportions of families with incomes below 50% of the average national poverty level than any other city in America, with the single exception of Newark, New Jersey. Among all states, Georgia ranks highest in infant mortality, has the third highest number of babies born underweight, the second highest number of high school dropouts, and ranks last in the overall well-being of its children. I contacted the office of Judge Glenda Johnson, the chief judge of the Juvenile Court of Atlanta. I asked her for some meaningful data on the dimension of our challenges in Atlanta at the point of poverty and crime. The facts will give you a sense of the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots in Atlanta. Henry Grady said of Atlanta that we have a brave and beautiful city here, and I agree. It is the city of the World Series, of the conference-winning Atlanta Falcons, the city of the Super Bowl in 1994, and we will welcome the world to Atlanta in 1996. It is the home of the strongest concentration of church strength, in my judgment, in America. It is a city of culture and education, of transportation, the headquarters of the well-known pause that refreshes. But listen, friends, listen, there is another Atlanta that threatens this brave and this beautiful city. Georgia ranks 50th among the 50 states in a composite profile of well-being for children. 39% of our youth who enter high school are not graduating. That compares with the average in the nation of 28%. Dropouts are 3.5 times more likely than high school graduates to be arrested. Each year's class of dropouts will, over their lifetime, cost the nation in lost earnings and foregone taxes $280 billion per year. Each year that a child stays in school reduces the probability of public welfare dependency by adulthood by 35%. And when they take to the streets, leaving school behind them, they are quickly absorbed and many are destroyed in the jungle that engulfs them. They find out quickly that they are in a world of drug dealers and pimps, and the cycle of destruction begins. The data speaks for itself. In Fulton County Juvenile Court since 1986, drug cases have risen by 1,700%. Weapons charges increased 73%. Robbery increased 240%. Violent crime increased 300%. Prison construction is one of the biggest businesses in Georgia. Joe Frank Harris, a great Methodist Christian, served 2 terms as governor, and he said if you took all of the jail cells that he built during his 8 years of as governor and placed them side by side, they would stretch all the way from Atlanta to Cartersville, Georgia. In 1990, 800 newborn infants were admitted to the intensive care nursery at Grady Hospital after testing positive for cocaine. This represents 15 to 17% of all of the babies born at Grady. In 1990, the Juvenile Court of Atlanta had over 16,000 cases filed. At that current rate, this means that between now and the time the Olympic Games come to Atlanta, the children brought to the Fulton County Juvenile Court would more than fill every seat in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. President Carter, speaking to the Atlanta Rotary Club, told us of a conversation he had with a school principal. One of the worst neighborhoods in the city is near the Carter Center. President and Mrs. Carter have sort of selected that community as the place of their concentration in the Atlanta project. The principal, speaking to the Carters, very bluntly said to them that the ambition of young boys at junior high level is to have an automatic weapon. The ambition of the junior high girls is to be pregnant, to have a baby, which gives them some status. The primary target of the pushers and the pimps are the sixth grade girls. They are weaker and cannot resist. Sex with them is cheaper, and they are so young, they are relatively free of age. Can you imagine? Into this situation, there is a common reaction. Those who are caught in the destructive cycles of deprivation, they give up. They have no hope. They are in despair. The despair turns to desperation. Desperation turns to anger and violence. Those who could help often throw up their hands and say, it's hopeless. And they frequently quote to me, the poor with you always, preacher. It's in the Bible. It's always been that way. Many who can help, who should help, who may even want to help, conclude it's like tossing a cup of water into the ocean to lift the level of the tide. There's nothing that can be done. Reality is that every one of us, every single one of us can do something. And that's where we intend to begin. It was Helen Keller who said, the world is moved along not only by the mighty shoves of its heroes, but also by the aggregate of the tiny pushes of each honest worker. Don't you remember the boy in Philadelphia who saw people cold and shivering, sleeping on the grates on the streets? He gave them the blanket from the family car. He started to ask people for blankets. And before you knew it, hundreds and thousands of blankets were being given and distributed. The Atlanta Project will seek to narrow the gap between the haves and the have-nots, people to people, people reaching out to help each other make it through this world. The Atlanta Project will address the problems that most afflict the economically depressed families: school-age pregnancies, dropout rates, juvenile delinquency, crime and violence, homelessness. And by the way, nearly 12% of the housing units owned by the Atlanta Housing Authority stand vacant when there are 12 to 15,000 homeless people in the Atlanta area. Friends, we can solve that problem. The Atlanta Project is predicated on the idea that solutions lie in the creative talents and energies of individuals and are only fully realized when people pool their efforts and resources. This includes less fortunate people interacting in a personal way with those more affluent. It is not and cannot be a one-way street. Each and every person must be involved as a part of the dialogue. Most must give, and everyone must receive. To start this dialogue, the project will address the needs of 20 troubled neighborhoods in South Fulton, DeKalb counties, and Northwest Clayton County. It is not to be a program of great dollars. Now, this church is going to continue to do what we are doing. We are going to continue building houses, supporting the Salvation Army. But I'm going to urge you, and I'm going to join you in making the Atlanta Project more than an ideal, but a ray of hope for many. It just so happens that in Reynoldstown, where yesterday we broke ground in building two houses, we intend to build 10 houses this year. We are committed to build 30 houses in that neighborhood. We are going to focus all of the energies and structures of this church toward addressing that neighborhood. We are going to get involved with the school out there. We are going to start out there a program that seeks employment for the unemployed. And there's going to be ample room for everybody in this church to volunteer and get involved. I can tell you this, if we are not successful, the festering poverty now in place will ultimately overwhelm this city and cause many who seek an environment of safety and sanity to leave it and to abandon it. Many keep crying out that government must do something. Friends, let me tell you bluntly that government cannot do it. They can help, and we have put together an unbelievably cooperative coalition between the governments involved thus far. The government of the United States is broke. It is $3 trillion in debt. It's because the people of this country want more government than they are willing to pay for. The largest single item in the nation's budget, I'm told, is the interest on the national debt. This is a problem that we must work out and solve for ourselves. The north side of Atlanta cannot say, you folks on the south side, better look out, your end of this boat is leaking. We're in this boat together. If it sinks, everybody is swimming for their lives or treading water as long as energy lasts. Now, second, when need that is obvious meets capacity that is sufficient, then we face what equals a responsibility. No one can look the other way, turn aside and ignore the realities that I have articulated. We have the capacity to change the cycles of poverty and despair. It will not happen overnight, but it can be done, and it must be done. We have the people and the financial resources to solve the homeless problem in Atlanta. We have the church strength in this city to address the core spiritual issues that must be challenged and changed. The heartening thing about the Atlanta Project is that there is a widespread coalition of cooperation emerging among the various governments that will be involved. And thousands upon thousands of people are eager to volunteer. Now, I like the plan that Jesus articulated in the parable of the Last Judgment. I like it, first of all, for its simplicity. It is not a grand scheme. It is simple acts of kindness where the life of one person touches the life of another person. Someone is thirsty, we get them some water to drink. Somebody is hungry, we give them some food. Someone is naked and it is cold, we get them some clothes or shelter. Someone is in prison, cut off from home, family, and friends, and we visit them. Someone is sick, and we check on them to see if we can help. It's the kind of thing that we're doing all day long, 7 days a week, and have for 72 years in the life of this church. Jesus is saying here, concentrate on the simple acts of human kindness that add support to those who need our help. There's no way we can program change in Atlanta, but if we will concentrate on trying to get to know people who need us, our very awareness of each other will be a fundamental change. The smallest act of kindness is worth more than the grandest of intentions. Have you seen the bumper sticker that reads, "Practice random kindness and senseless acts of beauty"? It comes close to expressing what I'm trying to say. On a cold day in San Francisco, a woman in a red Honda drives up to a toll booth on a bridge. She says to the person in the booth, "I'm paying for myself and the six cars directly behind me." The guy in the booth must have thought, "I hope she doesn't get a DUI before she gets that red Honda home." But that's what she did. She paid her fare and for six cars behind her. Can you imagine what happened? The six cars that came through after her were told, "Some lady up ahead in a red Honda paid for your fare." Just think of the good feeling that was involved in the random kindness and senseless act of beauty that the driver of the Honda engaged in. There are more than 10,000 people in this church family. Be alert to ways you can help. Keep it simple, but do it. If you see a rundown-looking school, stop and take a close look. If some of the rooms need painting, check with the principal. If books are needed, get a group of your friends, your Sunday school class, buy some paint, and paint the school's classroom. If you see a school playground that's growing up like a field of weeds, get a lawnmower. Cut that stuff down. You see, it all can just start right there. Boy in Chicago is shoveling the snow off his sidewalk. He looks around and there's snow on everybody's sidewalk. He shovels the snow off of a dozen of them. A woman in Boston writes "Merry Christmas" on the backs of her check so that the tellers at her bank will see it. A man in Atlanta scrubs some graffiti off of a park bench. What we need in the city of Atlanta is an anarchy of kindness that will be a sweet disturbance, a positive reminder of what it means to be a good neighbor. There are several hundred lawyers in this congregation. Gives you some idea of the burden I carry. I want several of you, beginning with our new member here today who is a lawyer, to organize a group of lawyers who will be willing, free of charge, to help, which is something new, to help some people who need legal help, who have run headlong into some bureaucratic quagmire somewhere. And for heaven's sake, for the glory of Jesus Christ, right here on this church site, let someone have your parking place some Sunday morning and ride on the shuttle. We're in this city together. Our very isolation from one another adds to the burden that many of us feel. I like the plan of Jesus. It was simple. Simple acts of human kindness. I also like the focus. To the least of these. To the least of these. I will tell you, yesterday I saw some of the least of these. Went down to the basketball program that we've started for the children in the Techwood homes. Georgia Tech has been wonderfully cooperative with us, and they have loaned us the Heisman Gymnasium. We are conducting a basketball league for children of Techwood homes under the direction of 12 of our volunteers, including an Atlanta police officer, a former Tech baseball star, and one of our session members. 44 children practice and play each week at the Heisman Gymnasium on the Tech campus. But we are not really there for basketball. We use the game as a vehicle for saying that we really care. Gwen Mayfield, the principal of the Fowler Street School, where these children attend, told us, and I quote, "You are providing what your children at Peachtree take for granted, adults who are genuinely interested in them." Case in point, in the 4 months that we have been there, we have conducted 48 practices, played 8 games, and so far only 3 parents have come to watch a single game or practice. And they live less than 2 blocks away. The people are indifferent, you say. Maybe. But does that mean we should not be there and be indifferent too? They are not our responsibility, someone said to me. Jesus said that they were. And yesterday after the game, One of the coaches took all the little boys who had wanted to go out for a pizza. They had a wonderful time. All the children were happy, and we've seen some marvelous things take place. Then he took the little boys home. When he got to the home of one, here's what that little fella, coming out of an environment of caring, coming out of an environment of fun and affirmation and encouragement, he ran into his grandfather, age 70, freaked out on cocaine, wearing a dress. You see what they're up against, friends? It is in the dailiness of life, in the ruts of the regular, that our opportunity comes. If Atlanta can bring the Olympic Games to this city, surely we can bring housing to the homeless. If we are in fact the number one business city in America, the best place of them all to do business, can't we not feed the hungry and bring hope to the desperate? Surely this can be a city where every pregnant mother has access to prenatal care and every child is immunized against diseases we know how to prevent. Surely this can be a city where young offenders have the help they need to turn their backs on lives of crime. Surely there is a way we can connect with each other so that all of our lives can be enriched through an awareness of each other. Surely the Atlanta Project can be more than an impossible dream. I can tell you this. I cannot. You cannot. This church must not ignore this problem. We cannot live with ourselves if we do not try. Lord, I cannot sleep. I have gotten out of the bed to pray. It's night outside. The wind is blowing. And the rain is coming down. The lights of the city would indicate that there are signs of life in the darkness. They beckon to me. And it seems that I hear the city murmur with a muffled lament. I know that in one single room in this city, 13 crowded people are breathing on one another. I know a mother who hooks the table and the chairs to the ceiling to make room for the mattresses on the floor. I know that rats come out and eat the crust and bite the babies. I know a father who gets up to stretch all cloth above the rain-soaked bed of his four children. I know a drunken father who vomits on the child sleeping beside him. I know that some men fight for the women up there in the attic where three couples are sharing the same attic. I know a wife who avoids her husband sexually because there is no room for another baby in that house. I know a child who is quietly dying and will soon join his four little brothers who are dead. I know a young boy who ran away in the night because he simply could not take it anymore. I know hundreds like that. And I was going to sleep peacefully between nice, quiet, nice, clean white sheets. I cannot sleep, for I've seen too much, and I've heard too much, and all of that has robbed me of my tranquility. I keep reaching for the rainbows, thinking one God's morning the hungry will be fed, and the dying hell, that the maimed will walk, and the violent will be crowned, and the oppressed freed, and the oppressors changed, and every tear shall be wiped away. I keep reaching for the rainbows. I know the promise of the rainbow. I keep thinking I'll turn the corner one day, and there will be a litany of rainbows flung out across the sky and the city. Every tear wiped away. It's a promise. It's a promise. When we become rainbows to each other. I want to be a rainbow in this city. Don't you? Then for God's sake, get busy. Don't just sit there. Do something. Our Father, you come into our ordinary lives.